what should be obvious is that when we talk about exposure, exposure for us has three dimensions. One is something which is uncertain, but it's not just uncertain, it's volatile. And it has a measurable financial impact. So in Air Canada's case, the exposure is to the three items we just spoke about: fuel, interest rates, and what's the third one? Some foreign exchange. Within risk, the biggest challenge or the biggest difficulty is not knowing where you're exposed, it's knowing what is the amount in question. So for example, in the GM case, they say we have exposure to X billion dollars, but we also have cash. So when we net out the number, our numbers is a lot less. In Air Canada's case, they say we are going to hedge ourselves between 8%, 30%, 35%, or 75%, because even though our exposure is high, the impact that it has on our financials can be managed between 8% to 75%. We don't need to hedge it completely in its entirety. So in the four cases that we've looked at or will look at, for GM, the exposure is to rising or declining Canadian dollar. Rising CAD, right? Why? Because your reporting currency, your principal currency is USD. In Air Canada's case, the exposure is to rising jet fuel prices. In Bank One's case, when you read it, the exposure is to interest rates. We don't know whether rising rates or falling rates, but it is to interest rates. And in LTCM's case, the long-term capital management case, your exposure is to changes in volatility. And why is that? We will see that when we discuss the case. Within the setting of a board, there is generally a document that goes out and states that this is how we are going to manage a exposure or a given type or class of risk. Okay? This policy document relies on three things. It relies on data. In Air Canada's case, what was the data? It was price data as well as their exposure to the amount of fuel they would consume in good times or bad times. Then it relies on a model. What we did yesterday was to build a model, which allowed us to figure out how the numbers that came out of that data were interacting to produce something. What we tried to produce yesterday was probability of a negative margin or probability of shortfall. So the three elements that the policy focuses on is data, model, and metrics. So this is the measurable thing that you're trying to track, probability of shortfall, model, the Monte Carlo simulation that you build, and data that allows you to look at historical prices and calculate and estimate the numbers that come out. A policy document also says that it is in our best interest to ensure that things stay within a certain range. So one of the limits that the policy document specified was we will not hedge above 75%. When you look at the Bank One case, you will see that we want to limit earnings sensitivity to changes in interest rates to about 5%. This is a limit. In Bank Canada's case, as well as GM's case, as well as Bank One's case, you'll also see instances of limiting the size of interaction with a given counterparty to a given amount. That's also a form of limit. And as we move forward, you will see that there are more limits that'll keep on coming in. And then finally, the last piece is process and control. So process and control is, I will not hedge more than 75%, but if volatility rises or if my simulation model indicates that the probability of shortfall has risen by a great amount, then I will review. So the policy, so this entire thing is risk management. The exciting piece is the model. The boring piece is the policy. The painful piece is the process and control. But when you talk about risk or risk management or the philosophy of risk management, you say policy, data, models, metrics, limits, and control. Process and control focuses on that there is a desired behavior that has been specified in the policy. That desired behavior should not become undesired behavior. And we control this by making sure that whatever thresholds have been specified are held true. The limit management framework has many pieces. The first piece is, I am Air Canada and I deal with Goldman, Merrill, and Union Bank of Switzerland. What portion of my business should go to Goldman, to Merrill, and to UBS? When I interact with them on a transaction, do I give everything to Goldman? Do I give 50% to Merrill? Do I give 10% to UBS? How do you find this out? So that's the counterparty limit piece. Then there is a transaction limit piece. On each transaction, me as an individual, us as a business, has a limit. So officially, I shouldn't be allowed to gamble more than $10 at a time, right? Officially, you shouldn't be allowed to gamble more than a dollar at a time. So that's a transaction limit. Then there are exposure limits. Under no condition would our exposure to a given currency exceed more than $300, $400, or $500 million. When that happens, we have to hedge it. Under no condition will we be exposed to a movement in a currency of over $5 billion. So these are exposure limits. Bank One saying our earnings sensitivity to interest rate changes should remain under 5% is an exposure limit. And then the final and the most interesting piece are what we call sensitivity limits. Remember in the GM case, when you read the GM case, there was a mention of something called a delta exchange. So a delta exchange is an indication or an instance of what we call a sensitivity limit. When you do the long-term capital management case, the LTCM case, you will see a full range of these limits being implemented. What do you do when the limit is breached? Or how do you decide where a limit is set? You decide it based on your appetite. Your appetite is a function of what you can afford to lose, what you can afford to risk. Think about a large bank with a few billion dollars in capital and a few $100 billion in assets. This large bank has thousands of positions, hundreds of counterparties, hundreds of limits across those positions and those counterparties. All of these add up to an amount. What is that amount called? That amount is called risk-weighted assets. And there's a very simple ratio that you use when you look at risk-weighted assets with the amount of capital that you have. And we call this the capital adequacy ratio, or CAR for short. The idea is, when I set limits, I don't set limits in isolation. I really like Merrill Lynch, so I'll give them 50% of the business. No. I look at what is Merrill Lynch's counterparty stature. Based on that, how much exposure can I take on them? Yes, I can afford to lose $100, but does that mean that on every bet I risk $100? If I want to make 10 bets, do I want to bet one bet of $100? I'm going to make 10 bets of $10, $10, $10, $10 each. So I'm restricting the amount that I'm betting based on the amount of capital that I have in my hands. Now the third piece that comes into play here is, when you are a participant in a market, there are certain expectations from you as a player. And those expectations are that on a daily basis or on a weekly basis or on a monthly basis, a certain share of what happens in the market will flow through your books. So now based on that size, you also figure out whether you want to take new exposure or you don't. What happened to Lehman Brothers? Rather, forget Lehman Brothers. What happens to Bear Stearns? You all understand what a broker is, right? A broker. So a broker is somebody who sort of sits in between two counterparties and helps them settle their paperwork. Takes care of settlement, takes care of confirmation, takes care of exchange, takes care of escrow accounts. Sort of a, think of it as a post office box where money comes and goes, money comes and goes, money comes and goes. As long as a broker is stable, is reliable, is beyond doubt with respect to its ability to survive, the broker can survive as a broker. But the minute there is even the smallest of doubts that the broker is not going to survive or there's an issue, people will stop clearing and settling. And when they stop clearing and settling, A, the core business goes away, but B, you also have a big issue with liquidity. This piece, the book size piece, requires you to maintain a certain stature in the market so that the people that you deal with on a daily basis have no doubts. But if you still want to limit your exposure, you can actually cut your limits in an orderly fashion in such a way that you're on the receiving end of receiving cash, not paying cash. And this is again something that you will see both in the LM case as well as the LTCM case. Going back to our discussion about risk, we said policy, data, models, metrics, and then limits, process, and control. So a target account is something that you use to run and manage your process and control function. A target account is something that you track. A target account is something, if it starts misbehaving, you would call a board meeting and say, we have a problem, let's go out and fix it. The primary attribute of a target account is that it must be measurable and reportable. You've done bonds, you've done fixed income portfolio management. Portfolio management. One of the elements that we use is known as duration, which is interest rate sensitivity. How much would bond prices change if rates go up or come? Duration is measurable and reportable. We used volatility. Volatility is measurable and reportable. We used value at risk. Value at risk is measurable and reportable. So that's one. It must be sensitive and relevant. So whatever risk you're exposed to, if you're exposed to interest rate risk, this target account must react to interest rate risk. If you're exposed to fuel risk, this target account must react to fuel risk. If you're exposed to exchange risk, this target account must react to exchange risk. And then finally, a number of times you need to explain these target accounts to members of the senior management team, and at times to your board members. So it cannot be a very complicated explanation. I cannot show the Black-Scholes equation to my board members. It will be a disaster. But what I can show them is explain the thinking behind probability of shortfall and just show that. Not show them how I arrived at probability of shortfall, simply explain the concept, the results, the analysis, the implication, and the recommendation. So the target accounts in the Air Canada case were P&L shortfall, in the GM case was factor sensitivity, in the Bank One case is interest rate impact on earnings, and in LTCM's case are volatility and value at risk. And how do you bring these three together? What's the relationship? Exposures are always gross numbers. I will consume $733 million worth of fuel oil. My exposure to the Canadian dollar is 2 billion Canadian dollars. What is risk? The probability that we lose something and is driven by external factors, something that you don't control. In Air Canada's case, there were four quadrants in the risk scenario. Three were under control, one was not. The one that was not is the one that we are focusing on. And what's target account? It sits somewhere between exposure and risk. Allows you to measure the interaction of exposure and risk. And using the process and control function, using the limits that you put in place, it allows you to react before it's too late. One of the most common questions that you see and you hear is, especially people who are new to risk management and people who don't want to spend money on risk management, is that if you do all of this, will this ensure that you will never have a problem? If you do all of this, will it ensure that you will never lose money? If you do all of this, will it ensure that you will never look bad? Risk management is not about elimination of risk. Risk management is that when you trip and fall, the process you have in place is such that you fall gracefully and that you're able to recover from it. But if you have no process in place, so if you've never tripped and fallen before, or if you have no process in place, then there's a very good chance that you will hurt something or damage something. One of the concepts that you will need for Bank One is the concept of duration or interest rate sensitivity. You have three lines here. This is the 1 year bond. So this line is the 1 year bond. And what you're saying is, what is the change in price of this 1 year bond as interest rates go up or come down? So at its peak, if interest rates are about 20%, this is worth about 97. When interest rates are at its bottom at about, let's say, about 0.5%, it's worth about 107. So total change across the full range is about plus minus 10. Okay. Then you have a 3 year bond. So this is the 3 year bond. Here the change is a little bit more. So your range is now about 85 to 125. So about 40 plus minus. And then you have a 5 year bond, which is about 75 to about 150. So about plus minus 75. So three ranges, plus minus 75, plus minus 40, and plus minus 10. Now, duration is an approximation that allows you to estimate how much would your bond portfolio increase or reduce in value based on changes in interest rates. Convexity, as you can clearly see, is another approximation that corrects the error. So for example, in this case, if I think about duration, I would say, how would I estimate duration? Duration is the rate of change, right? So how do you estimate rates of change? Slope, right? How do you get a slope? You draw a tangent, right? So if I were to draw a tangent here at this point to get the rate of change for the 3 year bond, this is what tangent look like, right? So I would just draw this line here. But the problem with this line is that as I move away from the point, there will be an error between what it's really worth and what duration is predicting. This error is the convexity adjustment. Okay. So far so good. The problem is that as you increase the duration or the maturity or the tenor of the bond, longer tenor bonds are more convex. So in this case, the two extreme examples that I'm looking at is, one is the 30-year bond and the other is what we call a perpetuity. A perpetuity is a bond that has no maturity date. It's a bond that will carry on paying interest forever and ever and ever, right? So it has infinite maturity. And if you compare these, at 3%, you can just see the change that happens in the price of the bond because of changes in interest rates. If you go from, let's say, 7% here to 3.5%, your change is about 3.5%, and your value of the perpetuity goes from 77 to 167, almost double the size and more. Your 30-year bond goes from 153 to 220. If you go from 7% to, let's say, 11%, you go from 77 to 48, from 153 to 111. So the second attribute of convexity is, which is something that you will use both in risk as well as derivatives, is that convexity is not just a correction term. Convexity is that propensity of an asset that allows it to fall by less when rates are going up and rise by more when rates are coming down. That was a quick introduction to duration and convexity. Let's move on to ALM. So now that you understand duration and convexity, let's look at a very simple, very basic example. And that simple and basic example is, I have a bank. So I have a bank, and this bank has assets and liabilities, and assets minus liabilities give you equity. So for this bank, let's say I have $100 in assets, and I have $90 in liabilities, which leave me with $10 in equity. So far, so good. Where is this money invested? Let's assume that this asset is invested in a 10-year zero coupon bond. Let's say this liability is a 1-year deposit. Let's also assume for a second that interest rates right now are 10% on the 10-year bond that you've invested in and are 6% on the 1-year deposit. So the bank has a spread of about 4%. Let's assume that interest rates go up, and they go up not by a very large amount, but they go up by 1%. So now interest rates are at 11%. What's the duration of a 10-year zero coupon bond? 10 years, right? So it's 10%. So approximately 10%. The duration, the interest rate sensitivity of a 10-year zero coupon bond is 10%, which means that as interest rates go up by 1%, prices will fall by, so you come down to 90. What happens here? This 90, here also rates have gone up by 1%, but here the sensitivity is only 1%, correct? It's a 1-year deposit, rates have gone up by 1%, 1% change. What's a 1% change? This is now worth 89.1. What's your equity? So now, if you pick up the balance sheet of any bank, anywhere in the world, where do banks invest money in? In loans, right? What's the typical duration of a loan? Sometimes they buy bonds, sometimes they lend money. If they lend money, even if they lend money, so let's say I'm a small business, I go to a local bank and I say, give me a running finance line. What's a running finance line? A running finance line is your overdraft line, right? It's like a revolving line, like your credit card account. The bank said, here's the amount of money that we've allocated. As long as you use payback, you can use it for a year. So from a maturity point of view, from a tenor point of view, you would think that an RF line, a running finance line, have a maturity of a year. Fair assumption, right? If you have a balance on your credit card account, it makes no sense because the credit card charges you 36%. But the reason why you can't pay it down is because you have other obligations and your other requirements. Same case with me also, right? So same happens with a business. A business draws money from an RF line or an OD line or an overdraft line, and it utilizes it and spends it and buys assets with it. It is normally not possible for the business to simply sell those assets and return the money to the bank, unless and until the business has positive free cash flow. Okay? So even though when you say that a bank has invested or lent money on a 1-year basis, in reality, it is not 1 year. A running finance line is the shortest loan the bank will give you, but the bank will renew that loan. Typically, assets of a bank have longer tenors, longer maturities. Liabilities of a bank are shorter duration, anywhere between 3 months to 1 year. Even if I have a 5-year deposit, you know, when the bank comes to me and says, give me my money back, what do I do? Now, even if the bank does that, assuming everything flows properly, so let's say I bought a car, I bought that car for $100,000, I put $10,000 in it, the bank put $90,000 in it, I used the car for a year, the car now worth $70,000. The bank comes to me and says, pay me back my loan, which has now about $85,000 on it. What do I say? I say, no. Bank will say, we'll take the car. I say, okay, take it. But the bank put 90,000. The bank only got 85 back, or 80 back, or 75 back. So even if the bank were to take the asset from you, it cannot immediately convert this into cash. But when I go to the ATM as a depositor, effectively when I put my card in, what do I tell the bank? Saying, give me money back. Can the bank tell me, no, I can't, I won't, I will not? Bank has to pay me, right? So there are two problems. The first problem is what we call the interest rate risk, or the interest rate mismatch. Assets minus liabilities equal equity. 100 invested in 10 years, 90 funded from 1 year, equity of 10, rates go up by 1%, the bank is gone. Rates go up by 2%, it's not just that the bank is gone, the depositors also take a hit. They will not get the money back. So that's effectively what happened in 2008. Not because of interest rates, but because of other factors, but the essence was your liabilities were more than your assets, and you needed money to take from both the US government, the European governments, and other governments to make sure that you survive. And if your governments didn't have money, then you went under as a bank. This is one problem. Second problem is that even if there is no interest rate mismatch, even if there is no interest rate mismatch, even, you know, you've invested this prudently, you've invested this wisely, the interest rates are in your favor, behaving as you want them to behave. Problem is, you have a 10-year investment funded by a 1-year deposit. And when this 1-year depositor comes back and says, give me my money, you have to give it to him. But when you give it to him, where will this money come from? You need to either find other depositors or other sources of funding. In reality, a deposit here is not what we did this when we said this is now worth 89.1. We did what's called a mark to market. In reality, in the real world, deposits are not mark to market. Assets are. Advances are. Deposits are not mark to market. Which then means that if we were to take the same example again, you would have assets of 90 and deposits of 90, which would leave you with an equity of 0. At which point the regulator would come in and shut you down and take the bank away from you, because you can't manage it and run it. So the ALM function, or the asset liability management function, is created or is used to manage these two risks and exposures. Hence, asset liability management, ALM. And if you break this down, you're saying there are two problems. The first problem is here with interest rates. They go up, they come down. Values change. The second problem is here with funding. People come back and say, give me my money back. The people who come to me, I have to give them the money back. The people, when I go to the same people, they say, nope, want to take the car? Take the car. What the ALM function does is that it focuses on the interaction of these four pieces. The first piece is maturities. It needs to make sure that there is a balance between the maturities, both on the asset side as well as the liability side. Looks at interest rate mismatches. Let's assume everything stays the same. When we did this for 1 year, right, we agreed on a rate. Our depositors gave us a rate of 6%. And we took this 6%. We said, this is the cost of getting this deposit, buying this deposit. We invested in a 10-year fixed rate bond that earned 10%. Now, a year later, this is still earning 10% because it's a fixed rate bond. But this deposit has been priced at 8%. What happens to our spread? Goes from 4% to 2%. The year after that, in our second, third year, this 1 year deposit is now priced at 9%. Then it's priced at 11%. Now what's happening? Now you have an asset that's earning 10% that you're funding with a deposit that's costing you 11%. Are you making money? Right. So the third piece that it looks at is the repricing risk. And then the last and final piece is the funding piece. If you think about the treasury function, what does the treasury function do? The treasury function says, from a banking point of view, if I have X amount of deposits, I need to have Y amount of liquidity, which is the amount of money that I'm going to need day in, day out. But the central bank or the regulator doesn't rely on the treasury function. The central bank says that if you operate as a bank, there are a few things I want you to do. I want to make sure that you are capable of taking a deposit. You have the right people, you have the right systems, you have the right processes, you have the right controls. And all of this falls under what we call banking regulation. For every $100 in deposits, I have two requirements. One is known as a SLR requirement, which is a liquidity requirement. Sometimes I also have a minimum cash requirement, reserve requirement, a CRR. So a cash reserve requirement and a liquidity reserve requirement. A cash reserve requirement is cash. It's a non-earning asset. I have physical cash either with me or with the central bank. A liquidity reserve is a liquid instrument but is invested in liquid interest-bearing securities or instruments. And the idea is that when customers come to me, I can use this, and if this is not enough, I use this. In most markets, especially emerging markets, this number is between 10% to 25%, the combination of these two numbers, CRR and SLR. The ALM function does a few things. One is it's responsible for making sure that this A minus L equals equity equation never gets even close to zero. Hitting zero separately never doesn't even get close to zero. The central bank takes it one step further and says, this number needs to be at some minimum capital level or must have some minimum capital adequacy ratio. If you hit this, we will take the bank away from you. And then the third piece that the ALM committee or the ALCO does is to make sure that these four pieces work reasonably well.